Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
Welcome aboard, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And this is one of our world famous Midrats free for alls. Melee, or however you want to talk about it. We do not have any guests today. This is just going to be my co-host pontificating about whatever pops into our noggins, and you are more than welcome to join with us. Right now, Scott's holding the fort over in the chat room, and if you're with us live, well, hey, I see Paul too. You can go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page, and especially for today's show, looking for topics. Eagle One and I have got some ideas of what we're going to talk about today, but there might be something that you or other listeners that are with us might want to talk about. If you have a topic you'd like for us to address, put it in the chat room. You're more than welcome to. If you're feeling really brave, you can also give us a call. We do take calls on occasion. But besides that, thank you very much for joining us, and let's dive right in. Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how are you today?
Well, I think originally, I thought I was fighting a head cold, but I live in a part of the country where everything is already blooming. The maples are blooming. The red buds are blooming. My peach trees are blooming. Yeah, we've already got springtime here where I live, so I think I might be having a little bit of a pollen issue. But so if I hack into the mic or sound worse than usual, I'll use that excuse.
Good plan.
I thought just to let our minds get warmed up a little bit. It's such a stupid topic, but we've talked about it before. It's funny, you know. You can spend a lot of time talking about rust and readiness and preservation, and not really anybody's interested. But if you mention uniforms, oh my goodness, everything comes out of the woodwork. So I thought there are two things that kind of uniforms can be serious if you want to get metaphysical about it. But at least this week, a couple of funny things. The U.S. Space Force now has its first appearance of a uniform, which it appears one of the best commentaries I've heard of it is U.S. Space Force is going to be deploying to Endor to go fight Ewoks because the bloody four-star is strolling around the Pentagon in his multi-cam camo with U.S. Space Force on it. And we've talked about it before. I like, you know, back in the day where if you went to the National Capital Region, you're either in your summer whites or your SDB, so you actually look like a professional. But that sailed long about 18 years ago, unfortunately. And then we had something that we were giving warnings a few months ago that might actually take place. At the Surface Navy Association meeting, we saw the CNO and also Admiral Brown come out with evidently the surface warfare guys, in addition to wearing brown shoes, are further compensating now by getting their own leather jacket. But it's not a brown leather jacket with not comfortable fur collar. It's, lack of a better phrase, an Arthur Fonzarelli black leather jacket with an Air Force looking collar. So I guess, and they were wearing it as opposed to their SBD top, which I probably is not going to wash out in the end. We'll see. So for all my Surface Warrior guys out there, congratulations, I think.
Yeah, I was really disappointed to find out they weren't going to go back through the halls of yesteryear and find the old SWOs, old retired SWOs, and issue us jackets like that. Although my comment at the original time when they first showed this was that I had a I don't know, nylon flight jacket thing that had a collar like that. When you get up in the bridge wing and the wind's, you know, flying around about 25 or 30 knots, those collars come up and just beat the hell out of your chin. So I'm curious if they have some kind of Velcro fastening to stop that very painful process of being beaten to death by your own jacket. But
yeah,
on
I,
the other hand,
I guess it's flame retardant.
Yeah, leather. Leather doesn't. I have welding gloves that are leather. They don't burn too much.
So we got that going for us. So can you wear them on top? I guess if you can wear them with SDVs, you can wear them on top of coveralls. Does it hide ink splatters? I don't know. We've lost complete configuration control on a lot of things. Okay, fine.
Well,
yeah, I remember.
Well, but the good news is, though, we got rid of those idiotic blueberries where if a sailor fell over the side, you'd never be able to find him again. So, I mean, I guess leather jacket.
Unless he got knocked overboard by an explosion, at which case he'd be on fire while you're headed into the water. So, yeah, it could follow you like a Roman candle until you hit the water. So it did have that advantage. Oh, my gosh.
True.
Well,
yeah,
and
the Space Force guys, I was disappointed. I mean, I saw a lot of stuff on Twitter about people's suggestions, everything. You know, why didn't they go with a Star Trek style uniform? Then you have to go with, well, then people are doing, you know, Space 1999 or whatever that one was, and you know, and some people had Flash Gordon costume. I mean, they could have done a lot of stuff. I'm kind of pleased they didn't spend a lot of money developing and having boards meeting. Of course, they only have, what, three people on the force right now, but having a board meeting of senior people to decide what costume they should wear. But, you know, it doesn't really matter, I guess, except I've seen guys in those uniforms that walking around, they look like laundry bags with legs, so...
Yeah, that eventually there's going to be somebody that's just going to go, listen, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but stop. Well, they go have to wait for the person with the right personality just to go, yeah, I can hear you whine already, fine, but we're not doing it anymore. Next slide. So that'll change. Hey, I've got an idea. We have a caller, so let's live fast and dangerous. And area code 360. Good afternoon, your old Midrats. What do you got for us today?
Hey, guys, I got a question. Sal, you've had up a few times, we need the 355 Navy thing, and my question about that is, do we need to do a better PR effort? Do we need to redo like a Victory at Sea modern version to tell people our story for the Navy? And I'm not talking inside the Beltway and the K-Streeters. I'm talking the farmer in Nebraska. I'm talking the logger. In Idaho, I'm talking the Silicon Valley kid in California to say, this is why you need a Navy. This is what the Navy does. And you need to finance it better because otherwise you're not going to get your stuff sold.
Well, thanks for the question. And if you look over at USNI blog, blog.usni.org, last week, I actually had a little post about one of the few people in politics that's actually doing this is as Representative Mike Gallagher. He teaches at the Service Naval Association. It kind of reminded me of a variation on the theme, and I think this is what you're going for, is a guy that's been a guest here on a regular basis, Brian McGrath, here about 3 years ago. He went around in the Maryland. I think he even ventured into the neighboring states. And he went to Rotary clubs. He went to a variety of organizations to tell our story. And it's very clear for a while that we haven't done that. And Sea Power, if you don't understand why it's important as a citizen, it's not going to be a topic that your representative is going to be asked. If your representative doesn't consider something a topic, you're not going to expend any political capital in order to pursue it. And especially under the previous two CNOs, I'm willing to give our present CNO some time to get his legs underneath him. We had the Navy, and Richardson was definitely bad about this, retreated from the public space for reasons best explained by him. And I think that, along with some relatively low-profile secretaries of the Navy, while we are conducting, two land wars in Asia, the Navy has dropped off of the radar screen with the following exception. The scandal involving Fat Leonard, the fact that we like colliding with merchant ships in 2017 and Westpac. So what did break above the background noise, especially in middle America, which you're exactly right, we just can't talk in Norfolk and San Diego and D.C. We've got to get out into the entire country. All they saw was negative stuff. How you do that, it's got to start top. It's going to take a SECNAV, and it's going to take a that gives the marching orders. Eagle One, I don't know. What have you saw there? You don't live in a Navy town.
Yeah, I think that. No, it's a great question. Sal and I and a number of other people over the years have talked a lot about sea blindness, which is what you're describing. People don't see the Navy unless they live in a Navy town. And right now we've got a lot fewer Navy towns than we used to have. And a lot of times, even in the Navy towns, the base is not necessarily highly visible to the people who live there. I mean, in Norfolk and San Diego, you can hardly avoid the Navy, but and I'm not sure how big a picture Bremerton paints in the Seattle area, but
it doesn't. And I know Bangor doesn't pay that much, but and with the noise, because I live just outside of Oak Harbor, the noise issue up there for Whidbey is an issue. But I mean, I can tell you, we have at post. Brack, we've consolidated ourselves, so there's a lot of places that don't see the Navy, but they see the giant cargo ships coming in and out. And, the only time I ever heard anybody talk about where I'm at was when the Maricasta Alabama got snagged, and then, all everybody was talking about was the SEALs doing their voodoo that they do so well. But, as a kid, I mean, I'm 40-something years old, but I remember sitting down plenty of times, and my dad, my uncles, my grandfather, anytime that Victory at Sea thing played, anytime on TV, we stopped. Why? Because that was a great show, and a lot of times it led to conversations with some of my relatives who were never associated with the sea level. What happened here? Why did we do this? Da da da. And people I know who were in talked about, well, this is why we did it. The big Battle of the Atlantic convoy stuff. Be able to get the merchant line over there.
Yeah, those are great points. And one of the problems with Victory at Sea is that it was that happened a long time ago, and if we were trying to show
right.
a current we don't have anything to show. If you've kept the sea lanes open for 50 years without, or 60 years, 60, 70 years, without having to blow anybody up for the most part, it's invisible. And you can't really make a heroic TV show about it. So every now and then we'll have some moment like the Top Gun, when Top Gun came out, that carrier aviation became a big thing. There were all kinds of people excited about it. I'm afraid that the underlying mission of the Navy gets lost in the glamour of the of that kind of movie. But you make an excellent point, and I think that what Sal is talking about with Brian McGrath did, and he's offered to make available to anybody who wants to go do it, to give the same kind of presentations to the various local clubs. And it wasn't that many years ago, actually, the Navy came to, they had a program, it might have been 2005, somewhere in there, they had a program that was traveling around the country, going to the Navy League presentations on what they were up to. And we need to revisit that. I think the Navy needs to make more effort on that. But we're not, it's one of those things is like being a submariner, you're this, they call it the silent service for a reason. So
right.
It's just hard to show what they're up to.
Yeah. Like I said, I think we're losing the PR battle again in the world. And then you start losing the PR battle, then you start losing the budgetary battle, and that starts an unhealthy spiral. So that's why I just wanted to bring that up with you guys, and again, anybody who's listening to ponder weak and weary about what we could do tinfoil.
No, that's yeah. No, you're making a great point. I think the fact that the CNO and the head of the surface Navy are both saying we need more ships, you know, publicly and rather loudly, is a sign that that attitude is beginning to, you know, the silent treatment is beginning to shift. And if they would go follow up with that, with pointing out, if we build these ships in the U.S., it's going to create this many jobs, and, you know, because you got to have all the follow-on effects, not just the shipyard workers, it's the steel makers, it's the electronics guy, you know, that's the thing that
yep.
sells it to congressmen. But trouble is, then you end up with, you know, we've got components made in Wyoming. Oh boy, Wyoming, and you know, so then you got this 50 state issue rather than, you know, are we getting the we want to build the best quality, highest quality ships we can for the best price, and not necessarily we'd love to have them spread all over the country, but you know, you want to get the best equipment you can from the best manufacturers.
Right.
We want to keep our shipyards employed, which is another reason we've talked in the past about how important our merchant marine is, which is also dwindling. So, yeah.
Well, the Oak Harbor area, that's a big Navy town, so you do have more presence there than most anyplace else. But, hey, thanks a lot for your call, and I appreciate it.
Yep. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Cheers. Yeah, it's funny how you can – continue to have similar topics come up on a regular basis, and yeah, you kind of wonder, you know, is it just me or is it in general? Because you know, in the 10 years, yes, we'll remind everybody of that a lot this year. In the 10 years that we're doing MidRats, it has been a regular topic about steep blindness and discussions, and you know, obviously it's of an interest to us, and we watch it closely. And I see it when I engage with people in general, we're invisible, and it's frustrating because we don't see us making an effort. It's almost as if we think we're entitled to the huge amount of money we get from the government, and we're not, and we are dealing with. They used to have a natural constituency, not because they understood sea power, but they understood boats. And after BRAC, that's narrowed even more. You know, in one area, I know politics matters, elections matters. It's in a political show. But Susan Collins of Maine and the Maine delegation has done a lot to keep, you know, Bath Iron Works up and running. And they arguably produced and continue to produce some of the best ships around. And one of the ships they produced, and it's not the fact they produced a bad ship, just the concept was horrible, as we've talked about before over the years. The Zoom Walk class, the DDG 1000, of those three ships, you know, one thing that we've talked about, not just us, but other people have, is, you know, since they decided that it wasn't a good idea to, what the advanced gun system, what was it, 150,000 or 250,000, you know, a single family home for a round probably wasn't the direction you want to go to. So what were they going to do with that? And I thought one of the interesting things, especially for somebody who was a critic of the program, is if we're going to have these three things, you know, right now they're just technology demonstrator, the world's largest 30-millimeter gun platforms. What can we try to do with them? And interesting proposal that came out, again, out of the Surface Naval Association, we had been discussing this earlier, is taking the Virginia payload module and put it in a ship where I assume the advanced gun system is right now. And, you know, if they're just going to load them full of nothing but TLAMs, that would be great, but they're talking about putting that conventional strike missile, hypersonic, golly gee whiz weapon system, which I don't think you can fit seven in there. They're larger. Maybe you could put four or five in a Virginia payload module. But even with a three-ship class, you know, with the old phrase, it takes three to make one. You know, what's the over-under, do you think, Eagle One, that they or we are going to be able to, after a couple of $100 million, actually get something that if it deployed to the battle group, you could actually use?
Well, there's a question for you. I just listened to an interview that the Proceedings, or USNI podcast, did talking to the CEO of the Zumwalt class. And interesting because first thing is that the ship is, as you've already indicated, it's massive. I mean, it's like a 17,000-ton ship. And
it's the size of a gross day.
Yeah. So they were, but it does have, you know, it does have a reduced radar signature, which is good for a lot of reasons. And it wasn't meant, you know, because of the standoff capability it was supposed to have, it wasn't meant to really close the coast, but it was meant to be close enough to fire its weapons and yet remain, you know, essentially a dory-sized radar blip to kind of hide, you know, hide out there. So it doesn't really want to operate. It does not operate well with others, I don't think. I think it's it's one of those. It's a class of ships that's going to be independent in nature, which is sort of neat if you're going to put some kind of missiles on it, or you know, it's got enough electrical power to power three or four medium-sized cities, I think. But you know, these energy beam weapons we keep talking about, I can see that, you know, being a useful feature of it if you're going to use it for some kind of fleet defense or something out there. But you know, I think the nice thing is you got this platform, and it is right now it's a platform in search of a mission, and they can play with them. Now the skipper of the ship, the Zumwalt, said that tumbled home bow actually works pretty well. But he was talking about a situation where they were unwrapping, and there was a Coast Guard, I don't know if it was a heavy cutter, one of the medium cutters alongside the other side, and it was bouncing up and down, and the Zumwalt, of course, 17,000 tons, it ought to be pretty stable, was just gliding through the water, wasn't moving at all. So, you know, if it's that stable in heavy seas, that's good news. That's a stable platform, and it's got a huge amount of electrical power. It's, you know, it can do. I think basically he was indicating the size crew he has. It can do one thing at a time well. so you kind of got to go with that. But I think that we get a chance to play with it. And it's an expensive set of toys, but you know, that it may pay off down the road in ways we can't even think of right now. And I'm very hopeful that that's the case. I'm not real pleased with the, and we've talked about this, I'm not real pleased with the way we've decided to name the ships. I mean, naming a ship after a former CNO, that's okay, Zumwalt. The second one is named after a Medal of Honor winner, the Navy SEAL, right? Michael Mansour. And the third one is the one that just irritates the heck out of me. I do not know why we're naming the U.S. Navy ships after Lyndon Johnson. I mean, that's purely politics. I understand that. But he was a naval reservist. He did win a Navy Cross by flying as an observer in an airplane during World War II. But that is a pretty low standard to name a ship after somebody. And I think we've allowed this ship naming thing to get completely out of whack. I was on a destroyer, and in those days, the Gearing class destroyers were named after Medal of Honor winners. I think that's shifted slightly with some of the Burke class destroyers, but I still think they're named after mostly after Naval or Marine Corps heroes. So, we started doing it with some of these other ships. We've got ships named after labor leaders and things, you know, and I guess if you're going to buy votes, that's one way to do it.
Yeah. When you have no discipline, ship naming goes straight to personalities and politics. And, at the end of this, end of 2019, I wrote a post about, let Kennedy be the last president. I thought it was ridiculous it would name a second carrier after JFK. And I had a bunch of suggestions there. I think naming a ship after a gunshot victim, somebody shot by a crazy person, was ridiculous, emotional. No offense to Gabrielle Giffords or her Navy captain husband. It's not about her or her being a crime victim. Where's Representative Scalise's LCS, who was actually shot for political reasons? When you lose discipline, again, it all goes to personalities and politics of the person who are picking the names at the time. And it's always bothered me when people said, well, you know, we named it after, you know, Vinson and Stinson, and then we started naming our president. So that's a child's excuse. Well, so-and-so mom lets them do it. Why can't I? That just leaves me cold. And unfortunately, and we've seen it again with the naming of CVN 81. Dory Miller had a frigate named after him and Navy Cross recipient. They were telling his story as far back as the 1940s on radio. His story is, or at least his character is in Tora Tora, even, not to mention 2001's Pearl Harbor, 2019's Midway had him on there. I know Representative Jackson of Texas is trying to get his Navy Cross updated to the Medal of Honor. We're naming the next carrier after him. Why? Well, it's not because that's the established Navy convention. It's not because we always name carriers after Navy Cross winners. So why? And that's the question people will ask. Well, why? Because it goes to the personality and the politics of the person who picked the name. And I'll let them describe that. I'll just say that it just adds to the chaos of Ship Navy. I think the British, it's kind of funny sometimes how it turns out, but they do a good job with their ship naming. The only time it goes into politics is if they're, you know, which Duke that's been dead for 300 years do we name it after, or which county do we name it after, or which adjective or adverb do you like the most? I think that's helpful. But you know, you mentioned some of the names that we did last decade after. I'll use Cesar Chavez. He was well known. In fact, he hated the Navy. He hated serving in the Navy, but we still named a ship after him. So again, way above my pay grade. I just think it's very disappointing. Nothing against the people who have the ships named after them outside of standards, but it's just, it doesn't help, I don't think. But that's my two cents.
Yeah. I mean, even before Chavez, there was the Samuel Gompers. I mean, as far as I know, he was a labor leader. That's so long ago, nobody remembers. I mean, I think it is what it is. They need to get, I think the big Navy needs to get back to, you know, we're going to name our aircraft carriers after presidents. We don't have, as far as I know, we don't have 45 of them yet. So we still have some names we can choose. I'm pretty sure that, you know, there's not going to be USS James K. Polk or Andrew Johnson, but there are a lot of other names to choose from. So
I just want to put this out again. I want to stake my flag. The best name for an aircraft carrier is Shangri-La. It has a little bit of a joint flavor to it because it's when U.S. Army Air Corps medium bombers took off from our aircraft carriers and slapped Tokyo just a couple months after Pearl Harbor. And when they asked FDR where they came from, he said Shangri-La. You want to talk about projection power from the sea? You want to talk about joint operations? You want to talk about innovation and good risk-taking? You want to see a name where people can think about doing their job every day. Shangri-La, baby. CVN 82. Somebody give me Shangri-La. I'm not asking for much, man. But that's a great name for an aircraft carrier.
You know, it is a great name, and we had all these other ones. I mean, now we've taken those names and put them on other ships, but, you know, Yorktown, Essex, you know, Wasp, those, you know, you go back to the early days of the Navy and the few capital ships we had back in those days, and even the Bonhomme Richard. I mean, it was the Bonnie Dick.
Yeah.
I remember that carrier. You know, we had the Intrepid. We had the, you know, you name it. We had a bunch of great names for ships. Well, you know, now it's, and you're right. You know, when you start, and we discussed this before, when you start naming ships after people who've been, who saved the Navy, so you get the Vincent, because he's the guy who fought for the Navy during the down years. You know, maybe that's appropriate and rewards somebody, but really, how inspiring is that to the, you know, to go back to the earlier topic about, you know, if you name them after famous battles and people have a chance to read about what happened, you know, like the Midway. You know, there's a name that ought to come back up. You talk about famous naval battles, or the Coral Sea. I mean, it's, you know, the and now we've got this other one, you know, Lady Gulf, of course, is a ship name that's out there now, I think. So it just depends. You know, we've kind of shifted this stuff around, but
going back to Lyndon Baines Johnson, what the hell are they going to have in the wardroom? You know, yeah, he signed some important civil rights legislation, but that was going to happen anyway. But all you have to do is scratch the surface, and you're it's like, oh my gosh. But hey, again, elections have consequences, and you know, people will name what they want to.
Oh, landslide, Lyndon. of course, you know, I used to work in Texas, and I knew some of the people who were involved in those shenanigans. And you know, there was a missing ballot box. You know, the whole typical the Duke of Duval County and all these people. Anyway, it's a long story. So
he represents the worst of politics, in my opinion. But you know, that was a long time ago. But we can't forget about it because we've named a friggin' ship after him. So at least for the next 30 years, people will go, "Oh, who is my ship named after? Let me go get a biography of him." And they'll be 40 pages in, and they'll be like, "Ew!" But hey, that's the way it goes.
Huh?
I just think.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I work for some interesting characters, but I never had any of the admirals or generals that I worked for on their staffs ever was giving me orders while they're on the Johnny Pot taking care of their daily constitutional. You know, but hey, maybe that will be a thing on the LBJ. They've got a head that opens into CIC, just no door on it. I guess that would be good.
Oh man, it reminds me of the Arnheiter. Reminds me of the Arnheiter affair on the Vance and his famous white toilet seat. So,
I have that book. I have that book. I don't think there are very many people under the age of my youthful that have really. I mean, I know your generation. That was big. That was really big. But the Arnheiter affair. I wonder if the author of that book is still alive, or has anybody written about it recently? Because that would be, I think, an interesting Midrats at some point.
I think it was Neil Sheehan who's written all these other.
I'd have to walk into my library to look. That would make an interesting movie too.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote A Bright Shining Lie. I think he wrote that book. He wrote that book.
Huh.
I'll think
about that.
And a bunch of other. Anyway,
a fun thing that happened this week for our buddy BJ Armstrong, he made me laugh because, you know, speaking of aircraft carriers, they get all the attention, and our poor L-class ships, Bubba, they get no respect whatsoever. The word to the people who don't like sea duty, don't take orders to the Abraham Lincoln, because the Lincoln came back from a 291-day, that's almost 10-month deployment, beating the previous record that was set back in 2003 by, the Abraham Lincoln, 290 days. So they're coming home, and their skipper's going, hey, we're going to stay out at sea one more day. Whatever. However, I think BJ's deployment, I should look it up. I think it was 320 on the Bahamas Yard. The amphibious guys had deployed much longer than that, but they don't get the attention the carriers do when they do those long deployments. And it does beg the question that we're doing 10-month deployments now with our carriers. I thought, call me crazy, a little over 2 years ago, we were going to make a substantial effort not to do this to our sailors anymore because of what we learned in Westpac. Is anybody ever going to say no again? I don't know. Good question.
I don't know. As a veteran of an 11-month deployment, I find the controversy, not on a carrier, I find the controversy sort of ridiculous. I mean, carrier ops are different. I think they're far more hazardous than if you're bouncing around on a amphib or a non-aviation capable amphib.
You were delivering ammunition to do the Lord's work off of Vietnam when you did that long deployment, weren't you?
Yes. And the North Vietnamese made a silly mistake of invading South Vietnam while we were still floating off the coast. That
no matter.
Yeah, they just had no. We were on our way to Saudi, but we never made it because we had to get turned around and go do things anyway. I don't know. I mean, I look at these cruises and I think, you know, how much has changed? People used to, you know, on World War II, guys would get on a ship and they were on that ship until the war was over. There wasn't as much concern about, they've been deployed now for 11 months or 2 years or whatever, I don't think. And, of course, we were just trying to save the world, so maybe there's a difference there.
Is that a polite way of saying quit your damn whining?
I think so, and stay off my lawn.
But there's it reminds me, there's back in the 1980s, there was a fish camp on the St. John's River between Palatka and Jacksonville off of Tokoi Point. I don't know whether it's still there or not. But when you went into the fish camp, there was your classic old Florida that is almost completely gone bar on the right, because the guy who owned it, he served on a destroyer, I don't remember the name of it, in World War II, and he had a chart of the Pacific under layers of acrylic on the bar that outlined where, and he was on the ship starting in Pearl Harbor, and the ship made it all the way through World War II, but had where they went to and the dates in the battles on that ship. And yeah, he pretty much, I'm sure he got some leave here and there, but yeah, you went to war and a lot of guys, especially the enlisted guys, if you're on the ship, you pretty much stayed on it, or you could, it was conceivable that you could just do years on the same ship. Different world. One of those things that you can't time travel, but I wish I had done more than say hi to the guy and had asked him. I'm sure at least he had some good Liberty stories here and there.
Yeah, I don't remember there was a whole lot of great Liberty during World War II, but I assume they whatever they got, they got. Yeah, I don't. You know, I think we've. I think you have to have again. We're back to the 355. If you're gonna do shorter deployments, you need more ships. You need to go to these, the Madison Spire. We'll send them out. We're gonna do surprise rotations. I think that may screw up everybody's home life, because I know when I was getting ready to go on deployment, every time I did go on deployment, a couple of weeks before I'm on the ship leaving, you know, I begin checking out for my family. And the family begins checking out with me too. So, you know, everybody's, and then, you know, when you come back, there's a period of adjustment, but it's kind of a withdrawal to, to get your mind right to go on a deployment. And I can't imagine, you know, that you, oh, surprise, you're going home for 60 days and we're going to send you back out. I think that would wreak havoc with a lot of people's psyches, but I could be wrong. So,
if you have a family, it is, it's definitely different. You know, I got back from my last deployment 10 and a half years ago or so, but, you know, we'll still be at social events. And my long-suffering and illustrious wife will talk about doing something with the kids, and she'll look at me, and I'm looking back at her, and I'm just blinking. And she was like, oh, yeah, you were gone. Like, yeah, I was gone. Because she's asking me to confirm her part of the story about, you know, what happened in Carcassonne or something like that. I'm going, I was dressed like an Arby guy. I was there. She's like, oh, no. But yeah, if you're a single guy, it's kind of different, because I remember, yeah, you said there was no liberty, but I distinctly remember there were a couple of times they went to Australia and New Zealand, so there might have been a story.
Oh, yeah,
there.
Yeah, never mind about that. That would be wrong to mention those adventures.
Well, there could be a lot of right. Here's the funny thing about history. And a couple of things I want to talk about, one nearby and one in the distance. But there's the ALCLED, A-C-L-E-D. I forget what the acronym means, but you can look it up at ACLEDDATA.com. Anyway, they have their regional overviews. And the regional overview this week for Southeast Asia, they have a nice map where they show where there are riots, protests, explosions, violence, battles, violence against civilians, and, you know, it's basically a heat map of where there's conflict in the world. And when you look at Southeast Asia, you know, in the course of a generation and a half, I think, or are we now two generations from Vietnam, but when you remember all the chaos and violence, really, from World War II up until, heck, the 1990s even, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, is when you look at that heat map, except for a couple of issues with land rights, which is amazing in Vietnam, but it's true. When you look at Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, it's pretty quiet. All of the violence is in what back then was relatively quiet. Burma, Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines. That's where the conflict and the strife that occasionally leads to conflict. I think the big areas of real conflict have to do with separatist movement in Aceh province in Indonesia, the Rohingya situation in Burma, and of course, southern Thailand has some ethnic and religious, as does the Philippines. But like the Philippines is a huge mess of violence in a variety of ways. You know, with the ebb and flow of history, you always got to be careful expecting what's going to happen in 10 to 20 years. Apropos nothing, but I think that map, if folks will go there and look at their Southeast Asia regional review, it's interesting how time can change things like that. You still there?
Only if I push my ONOFF button correctly.
I thought I bored you to death and you'd fall asleep.
No, I was thinking great thoughts. It's interesting how many of these countries that exist or exist in the form they exist because of the colonial powers that set them up. And, you know, we see the same thing in the Middle East. You know, would Indonesia look like Indonesia if it hadn't been for the Dutch? Would Malaysia look like Malaysia if it hadn't been for the Brits? I mean, and southern Philippines, you know, who should they belong to if they don't belong to the Philippines? I mean, you know, so you get, and then you've got the Christian Muslim stress, especially in down in the very southern part of the Philippines. And, you know, who's supporting those rebels down there that are in this, was it Abu Sayyaf forces that the Philippine government keeps trying to put down but can't seem to quite kill off.
The Moro Islamic Liberation Front? Yeah.
Those guys.
And I made a comment on earlier this week, or actually it was this weekend, about the problems that they're having in Libya right now. It goes back to something very similar. Libya really, from a tribal and even cultural point of view, really should be two countries. It was two countries back when the Romans had it. Well, two provinces back when Rome had it. And it goes back to, Iraq is really a spot-welded country to itself. It naturally breaks into threes. But there's a lot invested in national boundaries. The only exception that we've seen where the international community actually supported a breakup of a spot-welded, what I call a spot-welded nation, was the Balkans. And that's still not resolved. People are still fighting over a little boundary here and there. It was probably going to break up on its own, but I think the international community nodded its head and go, okay, fine, do that. But it's been very hesitant to do that outside of Europe for whatever reason. How much of the potential conflict around the world could be decreased a bit, at least in the medium or the long term, if we let some of these unnaturally cobbled together countries break into their constituent parts, if that would make them work together in a nicer manner?
Yeah, good question. Or would they just fight each other over turf and wealth? I mean, you get Iraq's a great example. You get the oil fields in the eastern part of that country. Who's gonna get those the spoils, if you will? I keep looking at Kosovo, having spent some time involved with that, and we still have U.S. troops in Kosovo, along with the other K4 EU troops, and I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars we've thrown at Kosovo, but it must be enough to make every Kosovar a millionaire, because I can't imagine where all that money's going. It's not that big a place.
And that's another thing. As my daughter's Serbian friends told her, it's like, when the opportunity presents itself, we'll take it back. So, garrison it till the crack of doom, or let things be decided on the battlefield. I don't know. Oh, for the listeners, ACLED, it stands for the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, for those that don't like incomplete acronyms. So, that's the long-term view. I just I found it fascinating how that works out. And even the borders of Vietnam, it's kind of interesting that separation, again, goes back well over 1,000 years. If you look at those really nice areas, it shows how empires and countries appear and disappear over the course of time. What we now see is Vietnam and, to a lesser extent, Cambodia. They've been nation states for quite a while in how they divide themselves, but there are other places that have been forced together over time, and I don't see where diplomacy has helped much there, except in the Balkans, where we let armed conflict and diplomacy at least be able to put a border on the ground.
Yeah. I guess it's been good for the people who visit the Dalmatian coast that they can do the Adriatic in peace and joy. I don't know why anybody wants Kosovo. I mean, maybe I was there during an unpleasant period, but I found it to be a very unpleasant place. So
there's not much there. It's typical poverty strewn and corrupt location, but I guess they grow nice cabbages there. I don't know, not to insult any Kosovars. I'm sure it's a wonderful, nice place. I look forward to seeing pictures of your acacia cottage that you go visit all the time. But speaking of time travel, I just looked up at the calendar and kind of shook my head. And being that you and I are kind of in the, maybe we're the the lichen or the slime mold of the national security media ecosystem. However, it was only 11 days that Iran lobbed a bunch of short-range ballistic missiles onto Al-Asad Air Base while American troops huddled in Saddam area bunkers because, for whatever reason, we decided we didn't need ballistic missile, anti-ballistic missile systems on our air bases. Different story for a different day, maybe. And it's completely wiped from the conversation and the consciousness. It's amazing how fast things, because well, this is going on, a lot of the overheated and under-medicated population was, you know, are they going to start the draft again? It's World War III. I need to go get my smelling salts. It's been 20 minutes on the couch. And here we are 11 days later. Almost didn't happen. That's amazing.
Well, it not only did not happen, the Iranians seem to be trying to revolt against their revolutionary leaders. I hope that continues. And the only thing time I see any stories about the Iranian missile attack on the U.S. is on the U.S. forces and the Iraqis is that, you know, the original claim was nobody got hurt, and then there, you know, apparently 10 or 11 people got evacuated due to concussion and stuff. So I don't know. I mean, it depends on how you define serious injury and wounding. Is a concussion serious? Is anybody dying as a result of them? I don't know. But, you know, that's the only thing. This guy needed killing. That's the other thing.
Yeah, like we talked about before, some people just need a good killing. And it was the usual suspects who were trying to spin this. Oh, people were into some conspiracy. I'm sorry. Anybody knows how military reports things goes, oh, yeah, it's only been 11 days. I could see how it'd take a while to go through there because concussions are funky things. You know, how you define a concussion. I mean, you think after 2 decades of having to deal with TBI, traumatic brain injury, we know these things don't manifest themselves for a while. Sometimes days, weeks, sometimes years, or if you're a football player, it can be decades. So there's no conspiracy here. It's just we're a big Soviet-like bureaucracy. You're not going to get heck, senior leaders don't get timely reports. How do you expect the media to?
Well, the other thing that's been interesting is that, you know, let's take this guy, Soleimani's track record, and then people are going, well, there was no indication really that he was planning an immediate attack. I don't care. I don't care if the guy was standing at the street corner whistling at girls as they go by and was innocent as a lamb at that moment. It's, you know, he had a history up to that moment, and he deserved to get to swallow a hellfire or whatever they took him out with. So
very appropriate named weapon for that guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now he had been walking around with this aura of immunity because he had been granted that because.
Yep.
He was saying it was too risky to kill him, and he heard that, and he's like, they're never going to kill me. I'll do whatever I want to because they're scared of what will happen if I die. And you know what? People, and I guarantee you there are more than one or two power structures in Iran who think we did them a favor because that guy was too big for his britches, was too much of a power threat to what they wanted to do. And, sometimes – you're not immortal, and he was not immortal, and he got what he deserved.
I think it sets the right message to the leadership of Iran. Hey, you know, we're tired of fooling around with you guys. We want to be nice. We'd love to talk to you about peace, but if you're continuing to pull this kind of stuff, you know, we can pick off your top guys pretty easily. And I think that seemed to have captured some attention. It certainly caught the attention of the people in the streets of Iran, which I am enjoying and appreciated. Yep. The president's Farsi message to them. So good.
And ultimately, the Iranians are going to have to liberate themselves. And I think not only in Iran, but in a few other places, there's an interesting dynamic in Hong Kong, too.
Oh, yeah.
That, and when we do what we're best at, you've heard me pontificate about this, and I'm willing to be proved wrong. We are not a natural empire. It's not what we do. Where we do best is when we set an example for others to follow, set an example on how it can be done. And when we try to interfere with other people's business because we temporarily think that's the right thing that needs to be done, more often than not, it creates a lot of negative feelings and moods towards us. Whereas when we stay out of their way and let them do what they want to do, America usually, by our example, is very positive. That's what you're looking for. We're not interfering that much in Hong Kong or in Iran besides giving messages of support. And on the outside with sanctions and other things, helping in that regard. But we're not going in there and doing their dirty business for them, so to speak. I think we should do more than perhaps we already are to support those that are trying internally to change the Iranian government. But if you're an optimist, you'll say eventually the Iranians will overthrow the regime that they have. And when they do, it should have Iranian fingerprints all over it because it'll be longer lasting and it'll be easier for us to reestablish our natural connections with them. Because, you know, a lot of people forget, people in Los Angeles know this well, in other parts of the country. Heck, I have a guy who immigrated here from Iran who lives next door to me. He's a great guy. There are hundreds of thousands, maybe it's over a million, first and second generation Americans of Iranian extraction here. And they're, as a cohort, they're great people, make great Americans, great citizens, great green card holders, and they have connections back home. So if we could get a normal existence between two nations, I think that they could be a great national partner, Iran can, at some point in the future when they can get rid of this government.
Yeah, I think the people, you know, again, it's like hardly ever do we find the people repugnant. We find the leadership repugnant. I can think of a couple of exceptions to that, but we don't need to go into that right now. I think that's, you know, that people want to be free. I'm amazed at how strong and how well, how long the Hong Kong resistors have held up. And I love the fact that Taiwan gave the bird to the Chinese again just in their last election. So, speaking of other.
Yeah, I think with each passing year, the people in Taiwan are going, let's just be Taiwan. And they do have, I haven't been there. I know people who have. And I can read the statistics as much as anybody. But they've done a good job there. And I think it's also interesting how they're becoming very friendly towards Japan, not just from a security desire, but culturally, economically. When they look at communist China and they look at the KMT, the nationalists who came over, they actually look back at the Japanese colonial period, kind of like the Estonians look at the Swedish colonial period. It's like, hey, it's not that bad. The Estonian view compared to Russia, Sweden wasn't too bad. And so for the Taiwanese, they go, compared to the Chinese, Japanese weren't that bad. So, yeah, that's an interesting dynamic going on there.
Boy, that takes a lot of history erasing to make that I mean, Japanese were pretty brutal in China. There's no. So,
yeah, they had a different lash up though in Taiwan because it was a colonial. What happened on mainland China by the Japanese is something out of a nightmare. you talk about something people should be more read up on. It's like, yeah, there's a reason why the Chinese have a thing with Japan. Here, read this book and you won't sleep for 2 days. It's literally something that Genghis Khan would have blanched at, some of the things that went on.
Yeah, somebody, I can't remember the name of the book. It was The Rape of Nanking, but it was a fairly modern book on that topic. Oh boy. Anyway,
it's almost hard to comprehend. But something a little easier to comprehend, I just realized, as usual, you and I start chatting and an hour goes by real fast.
We didn't get to talk about half the stuff on my list.
I know. It's because I can't won't shut up. Everybody loves to talk about drones.
Yeah, it's not me, it's you.
you and I can't make fun of professors talking too much. We really can't. I wanted to throw this out here because I think it's funny, but it's funny, but it needs to be taken seriously. You want to get a group of think tank people or people going to conferences all exciting and hot and bothered. You know, use the D word, talk about drones or unmanned systems, and you think it's going to do, you know, it's going to cure the heartbreak of psoriasis and everything else. But there was a couple of great pictures going along about the Chinese maritime militia. This little maritime militia, these innocent little fishermen, they keep coming up with all these unmanned systems that they are dragging out of the ground. It's kind of like when the Iranians managed to confiscate one of our little toys as well. We're a long way towards having capabilities people think they're going to have with unmanned systems. It's literally, we're in the Wilbur Wright era of aviation when it comes to unmanned systems. They're not that smart. They're not that stealthy. They're not that capable. They're nice, but my gosh, there are a lot of people kind of like, no offense to, I don't know whether it was Paul or Scott in the chat room who brought up railguns again. It's all on paper. It's all on paper. People need to calm down and concentrate on interim capabilities, because I wonder how much really sexy technology we're putting into these unmanned systems, where if a 35-foot Chinese, quote, fishing, unquote, boat pulls it up, the Chinese are going to be able to exploit. I don't know.
Well, I just hope we just keep sending thousands of them in there. let them spend all their time. Oh my gosh, here's another one. Wow, now what are they getting at us? I hope there's nothing in there but a bunch of wires and confusing looking things and an old CD of Steely Dan or something, you know? I mean,
yeah. Well, actually, you're in alignment with the Commandant of the Marine Corps. You know, he's in love with the unmanned systems, which I'll give him full credit. He's right about it. You don't need something really smart and really expensive to suck up a missile. And his take, and this goes back, I know SAC had those decoys on their B-52s as far back as I think the 60s. But a lot of these modern missile-based offensive and defensive systems, you don't have much of a bench there. You go Winchester really fast. And if they're attacking you or you're attacking them, and half of the targets are unmanned drones as decoys, that's probably not a bad use of them to have, because it'll cut down your attrition. So you're in alignment with the Commandant of the Marine Corps. So congratulations.
Of course, great minds are always thinking of these heavy thoughts. I mean, even the flares that the aircraft shoot off to draw heat seekers and stuff at them, that works, and it's cheaper than losing aircraft. So, but yeah, amen. I mean, I'm sure that somewhere out in the world, you know, you can enhance the. I think I read this in a science fiction book, which is where I get a lot of great ideas. You have little things that you can make look like they're much bigger and send those off and let that bad guy try to figure out the wheat from the chaff. So
It's worked before. Hey, let me ask you this. On your list of topics you want to talk about today, what's number one on your list of things that we weren't able to talk about?
Cyber war. But we can talk about that, you know, another time. We need to get somebody who knows what they're talking about on that topic.
Not like that ever stopped us before. Hey,
but
because
both the Iranians, I mean, the Chinese, the Iranians, and the Russians are, and they're not the only ones, are big into this cyber stuff. And I don't think we've dealt with the topic enough. I think this whole, what's the name of that company? Huawei, you know, that fifth generation cell system that probably just feeds information directly. Feeds directly back to the President Xi.
This is a family show, but if anybody wants to be very much humored, you can find out what happened to President Xi's or Xi, however the hell you pronounce it. His name, when it's translated from Chinese into Burmese and then from Burmese into English, it comes out as something that my 12-year-old mind found very humorous. But before we head off for the day, I know if people are still with us, you are hardcore Midrats listeners. So thanks for sticking with us this far. And because you love us, if you haven't already, please go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, nothing less than 5-star. If you have anything bad to say, send me an email so I can delete it. But give us a 5-star review and make a couple of nice comments, because that doesn't really massage our ego. That's a secondary effect. But the primary effect is in the 10 years since we started Midrats, the podcast ecosystem has expanded. There's lots of them out there, and there are new people, whether they're 12 or 82, who are becoming interested in topics that we cover here, and they're going to search on iTunes or another aggregator. And if you give us a 5-star review with some comments, they'll help us knock up in the rankings, and there'll be other people who can come in and hopefully like what we have to offer. And next week, we touched on a little bit of it here. The Service Naval Association, is convention or symposium the right thing? I think symposium is what they call it, but there's some convention activity that goes on after the panels are done. Dave Larder is going to be a returning to Midrats next week. He did a lot of writing on what went on there, so we're going to have him come in to hit on those big topics and maybe a couple things he didn't touch on as well. And we'll have a best of for the Super Bowl. And then we're hoping to have Dmitry Gorenberg, Dr. One Issue, come back on us to give us an update on Russia. There's been some interesting political moves there. But, of course, we usually just talk about the national security issues when we have Dr. Gorenberg on. So join us for Dmitry as well. Anyway, that's the coming attractions.
Some point along the way, too, we're going to get somebody to talk about cyber stuff that they can actually talk about. And we had Andrew, that was a couple of years ago, we had somebody on that was pretty good. So we can dig him back up again.
Always good. And as always, a pleasure talking to you, Gawon.
Yeah, have fun. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Aye, aye. And Paul and Scott, thanks for keeping the chat room open. And for everybody joining us, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.